How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing more for anyone to have.
Today is Friday, January 25th. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast, CITR.ca. Good evening. It is 5:07 p.m. and time for another full hour of independent news. Today, our headlines will cover provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world, brought to you by Democracy Now! And Free Speech Radio News. We'll be talking to Nina Scott about the Great Concrete Toboggan Race happening today. And also today, we have an interview with CITR intern, or by CITR intern, Alexis Cornwall, with a mentor at the Big Brothers Big Sisters program at King George Secondary School in downtown Vancouver. All this plus your weekday weather forecast, or weekend weather forecast, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now we have on the line Nina Scott, Communications Director for the Great Concrete Toboggan Race, a technical engineering student event that was held today here at UBC. Hi, Nina.
Hi.
Hi. So first of all, can you just give our listeners an idea of what the Great Concrete Toboggan Race is?
Sure. The Great Northern Concrete Toboggan Race has been going since 1974. It was begun by a technical college in Red Deer, Alberta. It's primarily a civil engineering student competition, although we've had participation from mechanical engineering students, integrated engineering students, and electrical students before, mm-hmm. not to mention materials.
Mm-hmm.
Teams come from all over Canada. They come together from groups between 8 and 30 people.
Mm-hmm.
They design pretty much exactly what it says on the tin, a toboggan made entirely out of concrete, or the running surface is concrete.
Mm-hmm.
It has to have a roll cage. It has to be able to carry 5 people, mm-hmm. and it has to weigh no more than 135 kilograms without its riders.
Wow. And so can you tell us a bit about the different designs that you see? I mean, I'm sure they're all very different, but are there some key areas that they're similar in, or is it pretty much a mixed bag?
Well, we pretty much have two main designs that we've seen so far during the race and the technical exhibition here over the past couple of days. There's the slab design, where the running surface is flat to the ground,
mm-hmm.
and there's the ski design, where the running surface is mounted on 2, 1, or 3 skis.
Right. Okay. And so is the competition going on right now, or is it done now?
The competition is actually just finished. We got back to the hotel about half an hour ago. We were at the mountain from 7:30 in the morning until 4:30 in the afternoon.
And can you tell us at all about the results?
Not yet.
Those
won't be revealed until tomorrow, and we wouldn't want to spoil the surprise for our competitors.
Of course.
But I can tell you that we had some absolutely amazing runs down today.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the teams had absolutely amazing speeds. We clocked speeds of up to 39 kilometers an hour down the hill.
Wow. And what teams were competing? I mean, I know you mentioned they're from across Canada, but which specific universities?
Well, this is actually interesting because this is the largest Great Northern Concrete Toboggan Race there has ever been.
Wow.
We have teams from UBC, UBCO. Mm-hmm. We actually have a UBC alumni team. They weren't competing, but they showed up and they pulled out some great spirit.
Mm-hmm.
We have the University of Alberta. They brought two teams. We had the University of Calgary.
Mm-hmm.
We had Manitoba. We had Concordia. We had Carleton. We had Dalhousie. We had Waterloo. We had Western. We had Memorial University of Newfoundland. We had Red River College.
Mm-hmm.
We had Sherbrooke.
Mm-hmm.
Brought some of the Quebecers over with us. Altogether, we had 23 teams competing from all across Canada.
Wow, that's
from
really
medical
exciting.
Colleges and universities.
Yeah, that sounds like a great event, and a lot of ideas that must be discussed. They're not just about the toboggans, of course, but just about the field in general, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's amazing. It's primarily a civil engineering competition, but I've met engineering students from just about every single faculty you could imagine. It's a great spirit that comes with Great Northern Concrete Toboggan Race. Everyone's really excited to be a part of it, and you get to meet people from all over Canada, from all these different universities. A lot of professional engineers and industry reps have also participated in Concrete Toboggan before.
Okay.
So they will come along to the technical exhibition where teams showcase their designs.
Right.
And it's a great opportunity for students to network and hear industry speeches. And I know personally that there's quite a few Concrete Toboggan alumni who've been hired from people that they've met during the race.
That's great. I mean, it really sounds like a multifaceted event then that helps out students in a variety of ways.
Oh, it is. I mean, it increases technical skills, it increases social skills, it increases networking, and really they just have a great time.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's the most important part, right?
Exactly. It's held in a different city every year and hosted by a different university.
Mm-hmm.
Next year it will be in London, Ontario, held by Western. And a lot of people, they've never been to the different provinces of Canada before, and it's a great opportunity for them to sort of see what the rest of their country has to offer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the evening we've taken the teams out and we've shown them what Vancouver's culture is like and done banquets for them, and they've really enjoyed it. Everyone here has had an absolutely phenomenal time so far.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us, Nina. It sounds like it was a great event, and we wish you the best of luck with, I guess, with the teams in the next year then as well.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So once again, that was Nina Scott, the communications director for the Great Northern Concrete Toboggan Race, a technical engineering student event that was held here today at UBC. So now we go to our campus and local headlines.
On Tuesday, the UBC newspaper reported that the AMS detected and sorted out a glitch that prevented 1,171 students from voting in two races on this year's online student government ballot for the AMS elections. From late Monday until around noon on Tuesday, students couldn't vote in the Senate or Board of Governors races. Elections Administrator Jenny Chen said the problem was caused by a glitch in the voting system that failed to distinguish between UBC students and students at affiliated colleges like Regent College or Vancouver School of Theology. Students at affiliated colleges are members of the AMS but are not eligible to vote in the Board of Governors or Senate races. Chen said voting is working now and emails will be sent out to the affected students, giving them information to vote in the races they missed. The newspaper also reported that there was also another question with the student government election ballot. The question about the voter media contest, which allows students to vote on how much money is given to blogs covering the elections, was not set up correctly when voting began. Two blogs entered the contest this year, AMS Confidential and Spilling Tea. The AMS has provided $1,200 to be split between them based on how students vote. Students should have been able to vote to give 100% of the prize money to one blog and nothing to the other, but the ballot only allowed them to vote for a maximum of 40% to one blog. Chen said she is working on a formula to allocate the money correctly and fairly, but it has to be approved by both blogs competing for the money.
On Wednesday afternoon, a diesel-run transport truck leaked approximately 100 gallons of fuel at the corner of Burney Avenue and Binning Road in Westbrook Village. Gabby Roder, a spokesperson for the Vancouver Fire Department, said that the leak was reported at 12:45 p.m., but that some of the fuel did enter the storm drain system before this could be prevented. He estimated that 30 gallons contaminated the system. The spill was caused when the truck ran over some debris, which ripped the line between the two fuel tanks, which collectively contained 300 gallons of diesel. The driver of the truck said, quote, "I was backing the truck up, and probably some rocks and dirt got caught underneath my truck, and they ripped out one of my fuel lines. Then my truck stalled, and there was diesel coming out. It was kind of a bad situation," end quote. The spill was stopped and contained by 4 o'clock. Roder said an environmental company will take the diesel-soaked sand away to be decontaminated.
A petition from UBC advocacy group Stop UBC Animal Research now has over 9,000 signatures. The petition asks UBC to ban categories D and E of animal research, the two most invasive categories. According to the Canadian Council on Animal Care, Category D represents, quote, moderate to severe distress or discomfort, end quote, and the highest of the five categories, E, represents, quote, severe pain near, at, or above the pain tolerance threshold of anesthetized conscious animals, end quote. UBC increased its use of categories D and E research from 2010 to 2011. In 2011, 83,800 animals, up from 68,203 in 2010, were involved in Category D research. 2011 also saw 59 animals involved in Category E research, up from 31 in 2010. Helen Burt, UBC Associate Vice President Research, maintains that research involving animals in Categories D and E, such as surgical procedures, undergoes scrutiny by clinical veterinarians and the Animal Care Committee before it is approved. Laura Lee Shaw, the new director of Stop UBC Animal Research, hopes to present the petition to UBC President Stephen Toop and the UBC Board of Governors.
A local social housing organization called Street to Home has recently announced it has raised $26.5 million to help stop homelessness. Street to Home has committed $20 million to the province and the city to build nearly 950 units of supportive housing on 8 sites across Vancouver. Sanford, which houses 62 people, opened in 2012. 2 buildings will open this year and the remaining 5 in 2014. Mayor Gregor Robertson said that the partnership has helped the city move closer towards the goal of ending street homelessness by 2015. The rest of the money will be used for other projects such as the Vancouver Rent Bank, the Aboriginal Mother Center, and heat shelters.
On Wednesday, Port Metro Vancouver approved an expansion to the terminal that will almost double its coal export capacity to 18.5 million metric tons per year from 9.5 million, an increase that concerns climate change groups who say that there wasn't enough public consultation. Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson said on Thursday that, quote, "It's very disappointing that there wasn't more public consultation and answers on climate change impacts on expanding fossil fuel exports through Vancouver. There are several more big fossil fuel projects coming. This will certainly put people on notice they're coming faster without appropriate community process," end quote. But the port maintains it undertook an extensive consultation process that began in June 2012 and included open houses, brochures sent to over 1,000 community members, letters to regional mayors and First Nation groups, also correspondence with over 1,000 people. Jim Crandles, the port's director of planning and development, said that a large majority of these people wanted to weigh in about the product itself, but it's up to the federal government to make the decision on what is exported.
And now we go to an interview by our CITR intern, Alexis Cornwall, with a mentor at the Big Brothers Big Sisters program at King George Secondary School in downtown Vancouver.
Alexis Cornwall here, part of the CITR news team. I'm here with Rita Steele interviewing her. She is a part of the Big Brothers program. Rita?
Hi, nice to meet you.
Rita is a high school student. She goes to King George Secondary, which is located in downtown Vancouver. So Rita, how long have you been in the Big Brothers program?
This would be my second year with their teen mentor program. I heard about it through my high school, actually. CR Feeder Elementary School is a few blocks away. So we do a lot of programs where we connect with the high school and the elementary school. And so the Big Brothers program is, and my high school is a branch for teenagers to mentor children at the elementary school a few blocks down.
What do you think you've personally got out of Big Brothers and Sisters?
You know, I think being a part of this program has really given me a new perspective on just how people interact with each other and how people get along with one another, because seeing kids every week and hanging out with them and seeing the way that they interact with each other and the way that they interact with me, it really is a new perspective that I didn't have before.
So, Rita, with your experiences, have you learned anything from your littles, like something, a new game, a new sport, something like that?
Yeah, for sure. I've learned a lot of new sports. I'm not a very athletic person, and some of my little buddies have been and others haven't been, but from each one I've learned some funny new games, some interesting ones, definitely imaginative. And other than physical games, I think I've also learned patience, which is something that I found really interesting, especially with my different experiences with different little buddies that I've had. And it's so important, and I feel like I've gotten more out of the experience learning how to wait for things to happen than I would have if I pushed them. So I'm just, yeah, patience for sure.
Would you suggest other people, teenagers, adults, to become big buddies to mentor youth?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The teen mentor program is really special in the way that normally we wouldn't be able to be big brothers because of our age. And that's really great to give the kids in the Big Brothers program an option to have a mentor that's closer to them in age. But I think it, of course, does have its drawbacks, like the legal issues with us as well, because Big Brothers is also liable for us. And so I really think it's important for adults to become mentors, because they have a greater perspective as well. There are things that I don't know that I can't teach my little buddy, just because I haven't experienced them yet. And a lot of things that I may not be able to give really good advice on that someone older than me would. So I think older adult mentors is something that Big Brothers could really use. It makes them seem less menacing, too. When a youth has an adult as a mentor that they see as a friend, it makes them less afraid of the big man and the, like, hand of power. So
of your experiences with your various different little buddies, what do you think your buddies in the past have gotten out of you mentoring them?
Well, I hope they've had a lot of fun. I hope I haven't been a real burden on their days. You know, it's hard for me to say, because unfortunately for me, I did only get to spend such a short amount of time with them. But from my experience, from what I've seen, from what I've been told, they have seemed more social, happier, and I hope that seeing me every day and hanging out with me every day, and I hope they're having as great a time as I am, because, you know, that'd be too bad if they weren't. But yeah, I think it is really hard to say because of how short time we've spent together. But I hope they've had fun so far. I hope they've found a friend in me.
Big Brothers recently released some research that they've been conducting, and they're actually celebrating 100 years of the Big Brothers and Sisters program across Canada.
I heard about that.
They did research over the past 5 years, and what they found in that research is that children, youth that were studied were a percentage more or less likely to act out or participate in bullying, be affected by peer pressure, and such other behaviors and similar situations. Based on personal experiences, Would you agree that Big Brothers is preventative of behaviors such as bullying, fighting, and other similar situations?
Oh, definitely. I think so. If not by conversation, but by example. And that's actually probably a plus to the Big Brothers branch, the Teen Mentor Program branch of that, because all of our little buddies get to, sometimes we do group hangouts, we do sort of group activities, and they get to see how we interact with each other, so they know what to look up to. So in my experience, I've seen bullying start within the Big Brothers program and end quite abruptly because of a big buddy stepping in or controlling the situation. And I've seen big buddies talking to their littles and asking them, what's going on? What prompted you to do this? And just having a good conversation. And it feels less like an interrogation and less like being hammered down on for the littles when it's someone that they look up to and aren't afraid of. So, yeah, I definitely see that.
Would you say, if you suggested an adult to go through or become a mentor of a child, would you say it's a commitment that's fully worth the reward?
Oh yeah, for sure. It's also not a huge commitment. It's an important commitment. That's the thing. When you commit to a child, you can't back out of it because that affects them even more than if you hadn't come in the first place. But big commitment, once a week. Big Brothers is once a week. And that's like a few hours out of your day for the adult program. I think that's how it works. And it's not that hard to take that time out of your day for a child. And it really is worth it. And you see it even after the first couple of weeks with your little buddy, starting to form a relationship with them. And you just, having someone look up to you is a great feeling, and knowing that you're making a difference in another person's life, another little person's life, it's great. It's for sure worth it.
What's one moment that you feel you'll always remember while being in the Big Brothers and Sisters program?
I think one of my favorite moments was a little buddy and we took out these small little skateboards. They were knee boards. And we took them out into the basketball court and started wheeling around the basketball court back and forth, going really quickly. And I hadn't been on one of those boards since I was, I think, 7 years old, maybe. And my little buddy at the time was seven. And just being on that board with him and seeing him laughing, and he was going much faster than me and trying to chase me, it was so much fun. And it reminded me of my childhood, and I was glad that we got to do it together, so.
It's true. A lot of people don't see the change that their small actions can make on a child's life. And it's important that we get to hear from the people who firsthand, who actually get to be a part of such programs such as Big Brothers and mentor children and see the change that they actually put out into the world. So thank you for doing this interview with me.
No problem.
Thanks to Alexis for that piece. We hope to work with you again sometime. It was great having you here. So now back to our UBC campus and local headlines.
UBC is reporting that construction is now underway in Penticton, BC, on Canada's largest radio telescope and the first research telescope to be built in the country in more than 30 years. The new telescope, with a footprint larger than 6 NHL hockey rinks, will listen for cosmic sound waves and help scientists understand why the universe has expanded rapidly. The radio telescope is being built at the Domino Radio Astrophysical Observatory and is part of the $11 million Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, or CHIME, in Penticton, BC. UBC astrophysicist and project co-investigator Gary Hinshaw said that, quote, "The CHIME telescope will be the most sensitive instrument in the world for this type of research, and the DRAO, the DRAO, is one of the best sites in the world for this research," end quote. CHIME is funded in part by a $4.6 million investment from the Canada Foundation for Innovation and includes participation from scientists from UBC, McGill University, the University of Toronto, and the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory.
Vancouver Councillor Heather Deal is proposing a motion for Vancouver City Council that would seek to recognize the city's cultural hubs, both official and unofficial, following the public outrage sparked by the closure of the Waldorf Hotel. The motion, which will be announced and discussed next week, will address both how to identify these hubs and how to engage the public for ideas to protect the spaces. The newly formed Vancouver Arts and Culture Policy Council is also being solicited for ideas and is expected to play a significant role in the new policy. Councillor Deal said, quote, "We need to identify those spaces, particularly those that are under risk from development pressures. The Waldorf certainly brought that to a fine point," end quote. The motion already has the support of the mayor and will join a number of other actions that City Council has taken in the wake of protests against the Waldorf's closure, including reports on opening industrial space for artists' use and making civic theater spaces more affordable for art groups. Those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your provincial and national headlines.
On Friday, January 25th, come to Seymour Mountain for the Great Northern Concrete Toboggan Race, an annual event that challenges the creativity, innovation, and technical skills of engineering students from all across Canada. Participating teams must design and construct a toboggan with a metal frame and a running surface made completely out of concrete. For more information, go to gnctr2012.com.
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pit my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back. Welcome to News 101. I'm Morgan Yee. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend brought to you by Phil Chang from the UBC Storm Club.
Awesome. Thank you, Morgan. Hello, listeners. Thanks for tuning in. Temperatures are slightly warmer this week, around 5 degrees on average each day, despite chronic cloud cover. We experienced a bit of a break today. The sky was mostly clear, but unfortunately, in the big picture, we're still heading out of a low system, so there are still predictions of precipitation on the models for this weekend. Continuous light rain is the official forecast, with 9 millimeters predicted for Saturday and 2 millimeters for Sunday. Now the forecast from Environment Canada. Tonight, increasing cloudiness, early in the evening, 30% chance of showers, low of 4. Saturday, cloudy, showers beginning in the morning, high of 7. Saturday night, showers ending late in the evening, then cloudy with 40% chance of showers, low of plus 4. Sunday, rain, high of 6. So that's your weekend weather forecast for this week, brought to you by Environment Canada and the UBC Storm Club. I'm Phil, reporting for News 101.
Thanks, Phil, for that forecast. Just to our listeners, you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. It's now time for your provincial and national headlines. On Thursday, the Supreme Court of Canada agreed to hear a decades-long legal fight over Aboriginal land claims in British Columbia. The land in question is a 4,380 square kilometers just west of Williams Lake and involves the Chilcotin Nation. The case is being heralded as a second Delgamuukw's decision, a ruling which occurred in 1997 and granted land rights and privileges to the Gikshan and Wet'suwet'en nations. BC Supreme Court Justice David Vickers delivered a broad interpretation in his 2007 ruling, saying that a nomadic people who use a large area of land periodically over many years had a right to claim title to that land. However, he cited a technicality and did not issue an order granting a title. The Chilcotin appealed this decision last year. Joe Alphonse, a tribal chairman and chief of the Tlatin-Coxton community, was one of the six nations that make up the Chilcotin First Nation, and he said, quote, "For us, the Court of Appeal denied the legitimacy of our laws, our ways of life, who we are as Chilcotin people," end quote. If the 2007 ruling is overturned, many development projects like Tisco Mines Gold-Copper Project near Williams Lake could be affected.
Toronto's divisive mayor, Rob Ford, won an appeal on Friday against a ruling that was set to remove him from office, defusing a showdown and allowing him to see out his four-year term period. Ford, a magnet for controversy during the 2 years he has spent as mayor, was ordered out of office last November after he was found guilty of conflict of interest, but he was allowed to stay on the job while he appealed. The initial court ruling said Ford was in conflict when he voted at city council to scrap a $3,150 penalty imposed on him for accepting donations of the same amount from lobbyists for his football foundation. On Friday, a panel of three judges ruled that, quote, "Council did not have the jurisdiction to impose such a penalty," end quote. That means Ford did not break municipal conflict of interest of laws, by voting against the penalty at city council. However, it is expected that the decision will be appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada.
Canada is reaching out to five aircraft manufacturers to replace the country's aging fleet of CF-18 jets, renewing an effort that has been drawn out and troubled. Canada announced in 2010 it would give a single-source contract to Lockheed Martin Corp. for 65 F-35 jets, but later reversed course as cost estimates soared. Ottawa has set aside $9 billion to buy the new jet, the Public Works Ministry confirming earlier leaks from senior government officials said in a statement on Friday that Ottawa would not talk to Lockheed Martin and I apologize on Friday that Ottawa would talk with Lockheed Martin and four other companies, specifically Boeing Corporation, EADS, Saab AB, Dassault Aviation. The ministry said it would send a questionnaire to the five seeking detailed information on technical capacity of fighter aircraft in production or scheduled to be in production. Once the companies have replied, they will be sent another questionnaire seeking detailed of cost estimates. The government last year tore up its plan to buy the F-35s after a spending watchdog said officials had deliberately downplayed the cost and risk. In response, Ottawa says that it could still eventually decide to buy the F-35, which has been hit by cost overruns and delays.
After 4 months of consultations with education stakeholders, Christy Clark believes the Ministry of Education has a framework for 10 years of labor peace with the province's teachers. At a media briefing at Surrey's École Élémentaire KB Woodward, Premier Christy Clark and Education Minister Don McRae unveiled Working Together for Students, a framework for long-term stability in education, a plan that reevaluates the essential services designation for teachers, indexes teacher salaries with other public employees, provides $100 million to the Priority Education Investment Fund, and creates an education policy committee composed of government, trustees, and teachers. Clark repeated the hope she expressed last fall that this framework would make 10-year teacher agreements possible. Salary increases will be indexed to the public sector agreements for nurses, college faculty, and government employees. If the indexing started 10 years ago, government says teachers' salaries would have increased by an average of 2% as opposed to the 1.8% averages teachers have received. And those are your provincial and national headlines for today. We are going to take a quick break, but do you stay with us for our international news?
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Explore the arts this winter at League Square Community Arts Village. They're offering an exciting lineup of visual and performing arts programs this winter, including capoeira, Brazilian dance, and martial arts for 3 to 12-year-olds. Parent and taught jam sessions, the iGirl Empowerment and Art Workshop for ages 9 to 12, and adult classes in digital photo editing and photography, just to name a few. Registration is available online at experienceit.ca or call 604-927-7529 for a full listing of arts and culture programs in Port Coquitlam. For more information on Lee Square, please visit portcoquitlam.ca/arts or call 604-927-8400.
And welcome back to News 101. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. It is now time for our international headlines, brought to you by Free Speech Radio News.
Headlines for FSRN. Thousands of protesters were out in the streets of the Egyptian capital today, marking the second anniversary of the largely peaceful revolution that deposed longtime leader Hosni Mubarak. The demonstrations were violent in places, and international media report more than 100 people have been injured. Many of the protesters were secular opponents of the newly elected Islamist government of Mohamed Morsi. Yesterday, Amnesty International criticized the Morsi government of not doing enough to prosecute those responsible for the deaths of protesters during the 2011 demonstrations. A federal ban on spreading the so-called propaganda of homosexuality to children passed its first review of the Russian lower house of parliament today. Similar bans have been passed in several cities throughout the country, and today's vote signals it will soon be put in place nationwide. FSRN's Yekaterina Danilova reports.
Only one member of parliament voted against the measure as protest by a group of LGBT rights advocates happened outside. The activists were attacked with eggs and paint by some people who had come out to support the law. Police arrested 20 of the LGBT activists. Natalia Tsimbalova is a member of the group Alliance of Heterosexuals for LGBT Equality. She said the stated objective of protecting children is another example of the state using children to forward its agenda.
This law will actually hurt children because it will cause an increase in suicides amongst teenagers, as psychologists predict. In addition, this law has almost fascist characteristics because it divides people into first and second classes.
The second review of the law is scheduled for May. LGBT activists are organizing a rally in February to oppose the law. Екатерина Данилова, FSRN, Russia.
In more encouraging news for LGBT rights, British lawmakers today introduced a law that would legalize same-sex marriage. The first vote on the law is expected in early February. In addition, the Rhode Island House of Representatives passed marriage equality legislation by a wide margin yesterday. The bill now moves to the Senate, where it faces greater opposition. Indian authorities are calling for a harsher punishment for an American man convicted of helping plan the Mumbai terrorist attacks of 2008. Late yesterday, a federal judge in Chicago sentenced David Headley to 35 years in prison for his part in what India considers its own 9/11. The three-day siege of locations around the city left more than 160 people dead. FSRN's Jay Saper reports from Illinois.
Pakistan-educated American David Headley used his clean-cut appearance and a video camera to map detailed targets for the three-day killing spree. The 35-year sentence is causing controversy. Many feel Headley should have been dealt with as harshly as those who attacked the Twin Towers in New York. But defense lawyer Rob Cedar and Assistant U.S. Attorney Gary Shapiro both indicated, despite the horrific crime, the lesser sentence could actually prevent future mass attacks.
Mr. Headley's letter to the judge expressed his sincere remorse about what led him to this and how sorry he was.
We were trying to come up with a sentence that was incredibly severe, yet left some incentive for future cooperators to look at and think, at least I can get some benefit in helping the United States government.
Notably, Headley turned over an accomplice who provided support for the planned murder of Danish newspaper employees who ran cartoons lampooning the Prophet Muhammad. Thursday's sentence spared Headley harsher possibilities, like life in prison or being sent to India. Jay Saper, FSRN, Chicago.
The U.S. Senate passed two reforms Thursday night aimed at reducing partisan gridlock. While President Obama praised the rule changes as a positive step, lawmakers from both parties remain critical. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's James Helmsworth has more.
The Senate's new rules limit filibusters on motions to proceed to 4 hours, which could allow Congress to begin debating bills more quickly. The resolution, crafted by leaders from both major parties, also included a 2-year guarantee allowing the Republican minority a minimum number of amendments to any legislation. Yet the reforms fall short of the changes some political accountability groups desired. Common Cause, which is currently suing the Senate for its use of the filibuster, called this compromise bill a capitulation. Many Democrats have also been calling for more sweeping reforms, citing several bills, like the DREAM Act, that were killed by the filibuster. One proposed plan would have reinstated the talking filibuster, in which senators must speak on the floor to block a vote on a bill. Another proposal would have made it significantly more difficult for a filibuster to be sustained. A handful of Senate Republicans voted against the deal, claiming it will disempower the minority. James Helmsworth, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Since France began military intervention in Mali earlier this month, some 7,500 refugees fleeing the violence have crossed borders to nearby countries, according to the UN Refugee Agency. UN spokesperson Adrian Edwards said refugees in Mauritania, Niger, and Burkina Faso face shortages of food and fuel.
A lack of cereal is pushing breeders to either kill some of the animals they have or try to sell them. Some refugees are travelling by private car or truck to the borders, while others have arrived by Mali on foot or by donkey.
People along the shared border with Senegal are also growing concerned about the effects of the fighting on their daily lives. FSRN's Alpha Diallo went to the town of Diboli to find out how the ongoing crisis in the north is impacting the lives of ordinary people.
In the border town of Kidira, Kumba Sisoko runs a small restaurant, although she is hundreds of miles away from the fighting in the north of Mali. She is worried about her family. She left them behind last year when she fled the Islamist incursion in the town of Gao. Sisoko said she welcomed the French military intervention but calls on both the government of France and Mali to minimize civilian casualties.
We, the Malian community here, are very happy about the French military operation. But to tell you the truth, if I watch TV and see the intensity of the airstrikes in the north, I cannot sleep. It's been 3 days now that I have tried to call my family in Gao, but to no avail. I am really worried as to what might happen to my relatives who are still in Gao. I pray that this crisis will soon come to pass so that I can go back.
In both Diboli and Kidira, there's a large community of Senegalese who depend on Mali for their textile trade. Many Senegalese businessmen and women regularly travel to Mali to buy large quantities of Thai and dye clothes and fabric, which they resell in Senegal at a profit. Maria Madem says if hostilities continue, it could affect her textile shop, where she employs three assistants.
I wish the problems in northern Mali will come to pass soon, because since the problems started last year, I stopped going to Mali to buy goods. Business is good in Mali, especially on tie and dye textiles, but because of the fighting, many of us have stopped going there. I therefore pray for peace in Mali.
The common border between Dibole and Kidira has been quieter with fewer activities, but some say they haven't noticed much of a change. Sangin Transport Company coordinator Mark Conati says the current crisis in Mali's north is not yet affecting their business. Her company owns the largest fleet of buses which travel between Dakar, Senegal and Bamako, Mali.
Well, as you can see for yourself, there is no problem here. Our buses are going to Bamako every day. It is just like comparing the Casamance situation to the current crisis in the north. The scene of the fighting is far away from the capital, Bamako. The problem is not in any way affecting our services. Passengers are coming to book for trips to Mali every day.
Senegal is preparing for a possible influx of refugees. According to the UN Refugee Agency, up to 700,000 people could be displaced by the current crisis. Alpha Diallo, Free Speech Radio News, Dibole, southwestern Mali.
In Madison, Wisconsin, people filled a contentious public hearing at the Capitol today to express opposition to state legislation that would weaken environmental regulation and pave the way for a massive iron ore mine in the northwest of the state near Lake Superior. Supporters of the mine, to be operated by Gogebic Tassonite Mining Company, say it would create much-needed jobs for the state. But critics say it could damage vital water resources and threaten tribal land in the area. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's review of legislative records, staff of Republican lawmakers worked alongside lobbyists with Gogebic Tassonite in order to draft legislation in 2011, but it failed to become law then. Today's public hearing was in front of the State Senate and Assembly Mining Committees as lawmakers consider legislation this term. Some of those who attended the hearing are from the Bad River Band of Chippewa Indians, one of the communities near the site of the iron mine. For more, we go to Adena, Wisconsin, to speak with Cherie Perro, a member of the Bad River Band. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much.
What are your primary concerns with this legislation?
First of all, our treaty rights. You know, we're all families up here. We have a community up here. We need the water. We have a right to clean water. And it infringes on our federally recognized Chippewa Treaty rights when it comes to our water rights and our shared water.
How do you think this project could damage or could affect your water up there?
The proposed open pit mine is going to be that they want it to be. It is at the headwaters of the Bad River, which runs directly through a reservation and into Lake Superior. And it just will not affect the Bad River tribe. It will affect everybody through this waterway. There are people in Mellon that have farms that have been in Mellon for 100 years that we've just talked to. They have livestock. They have, they do their beef, their cheese, their milk, everything. I mean, when they start blasting to make an open pit mine, where's those particles going? It's going in the air. It's going to hit the ground. The farm animals obviously eat from there. It's going to hit their well, the water that they drink in. We have our beloved wild rice here that we harvest every single year. And, all of this is gone.
You describe the rice and how important that is for your culture traditionally. What about the waterways, the rivers, the lakes? Can you describe what that means for you?
Do you have like 5 hours? it's such a heartfelt topic to talk about because we have, you can look at our Facebook pages and you can see the pictures that we've posted before this was even going on about our kids swimming in there. We fished there. Obviously, we just talked about our wild rice. I have pictures of my grandson, he's 9 years old, fishing in the Bad River. That could all be gone if this happens.
Is there mining right now in the area there?
No, not in Ashland County, no.
Now, there are supporters of the legislation and the project. One of them, most visibly, is Governor Scott Walker. He's a strong supporter. He mentioned the project specifically in his State of the Union address last week. He said a mine would be a lifeline to people in the northwestern Wisconsin, where the unemployment rate in Iron Country is the second highest in the state at nearly 12%. He said the benefits will be felt all across Wisconsin. He called it a lifeline to people in northwestern Wisconsin. Your community is in northwestern part of the state. Your response to Governor Walker?
It's a lifeline to genocide for us up here in this area. He doesn't live here. We don't matter to him, so it doesn't matter what goes on up here. We do not matter to Governor Scott Walker, so it doesn't matter what's going on up here. That's my personal feeling. Everybody has their own feeling. Personally, that's mine.
Well, with that argument with jobs, are you seeing any possibility of jobs for people in your community because of this project or anything like that?
No. You can, again, look at the statistics of the area up here. He's making it sound like we're all, suffering or something up here, and that's just not the way it is. I'm not going to mention any names, but we've met with a representative just maybe a week or so ago, some of us from the organization, and he's like, this place is beautiful. I mean, he just couldn't believe how beautiful this place was up here.
To your knowledge, has the governor visited your community up there?
No, he has not.
And finally, you mentioned your own grandson, 9 years old, other people in your community. What are your hopes for the next generation with a project like this, or with alternatives? What's an alternative to this kind of project?
I'm not sure if there is an alternative for this kind of a project. I mean, we're here for seven generations. We're here to protect and to pass on for another seven generations clean water, the right to harvest, the right to hunt, to fish. I mean, when you see your grandson out in the middle of the mouth of the Bad River, I mean, it's like magical. I mean, you don't see something like that every single day. And when he's out there fishing and he's got a fish with a nice fishing pole, you could look at that picture and say, well, this is what we used to do up here. We can't do it anymore because there's acid drainage running off from the Pinocchio Hills because they put an open pit mine over here.
Cherie Perro is a member of the Bad River Band of Chippewa Indians. She joined us to discuss proposed legislation in Wisconsin that could pave the way for an iron mine near her community. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
So, thanks to Free Speech Radio News for that segment. You can listen to their daily headlines as well as their full newscast on their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that's our program for today, Friday, January 25th, 2013. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Phil Chang. Today's show was produced by Morgan Yee. From the entire news show here at CITR, thank you for listening.
Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.